Sorry. Yeah. Shall we get started? Opposite to what we have done in the previous weeks with the... Opposite to what we have done in the previous week, now the exercise sessions will be more lecture, will be a bit more lecture type. I will first present research that we have done here and that we are going to do in the future in keystroke dynamics. Jürgen will next present something that he has done as a project topic in the biometrics course last semester. And then Emil, together with Guo Zhang, who is sitting there in the middle, they will demonstrate fingerprint recognition on this device there. I hope that the recording will go okay, so I'm not sure of that. Seems to have stopped here. But we'll just see. For you, anyway, you can follow everything. Okay. Research in keystroke dynamics at NTNU/Norwegian Biometric Laboratory. Guo Zhang is wearing the same sweater as me, are you?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay, the good one. This is actually, there is a fingerprint at the back, so this is really to give the Norwegian Biometrics Lab its own identity. We made them in early this year in the winter time, so for the annual workshop that we're having. Okay, let me say something about keystroke dynamics. Keystroke dynamics is one of the biometrics where we recognize a person based on the way that they use a keyboard. And when I use a keyboard, every key that I type, I actually do two things. I press a key down and I release the key. and I can measure when I press down the key and when I release the key. That's all I get, generally. So normally we get information on when keys are pressed and released. That's the raw data that we get. We extract some features from that. So that's the biometric sample, what we talked about this morning. The features that we extract, the biometric template, that is how long was this key kept down? How long does it take me to go from one key to the next key? These kinds of information. We call that duration and latency. That's not so important for this presentation. But beside that, we get some more. Is this connected? Yeah. Okay. If I type on this one, you can hear the keys that I'm typing. So a keyboard, when you type on it, it produces a sound. So we have done here also some research where we had, this is actually a webcam with a microphone here, where we actually measured the sound of somebody typing, and that's not our research, but other researchers have focused on using a webcam and seeing what somebody was typing with the camera. They recorded also sound, they did more than just the video analysis. Yeah, so these are features that we can extract. Timing features, sound features, video, things like this. So what's the essence of keystroke dynamics? If I have my password and I type the password and I use keystroke dynamics in addition, then we're not so much checking what somebody typed, the password, but we check how somebody types it. In addition, obviously, we check if somebody typed the correct password. We don't forget that. Yeah, so, but in keystroke dynamics, you want to get access to this machine. You type your password. I check if it's a correct password. And if it's a correct password, I also check how the password is typed. So in principle, I'm preventing now shoulder surfing. Well, not preventing shoulder surfing. I can still see what password you type, but I don't get the typing rhythm. So part of the information is missing. Experiments have shown that, not just our experiments, but in general, experiments have shown that it is hard to mimic the typing behavior of some person. So even if I know how somebody types, and I know his password, I still will have trouble getting into that system because I can't mimic how somebody did that. So that's one thing that is difficult. There are some different results on this. The initial research we did here, there was a master student doing that. His conclusion was it's difficult. Depending on the information that you get, on the feedback that the system will give you, it might be easier or more difficult. Then there was, a couple of years ago, research from somewhere in Asia, I forgot the country, that actually had the opposite conclusion. They said, no, it's relatively easy. And then we did some more research on that, and we landed a bit in the middle, saying, okay, if it's an easy password, like welcome42, I can mimic much more easier than when it is a completely random password, then I have trouble mimicking that. From the research we did on timing information, we noticed that if I look at sound information, we noticed that timing information can best be used for authentication purposes, while for identification purposes, the audio signal gave much better results. And if you listen to this, if our storm is laying down, I hope you can hear it. Let me turn up this. Okay. Was that audible? Okay, that was one person typing a password, and this is another one typing the exact same password, different person. I'm not sure if that was audible, but the first one was fast and was hitting the keys very hard. It was clearly here. And the second one was more or less gliding over the keys and much slower. Yeah, two different styles of typing. So that's research we have done here. Language of the type word plays a role. Yeah, generally a password is a password. It's the same every time, so I type the same thing. But if you are going to do online banking, for example, you have this minnebrik here in Norway, and you get this random number that you have to type into the online bank application. Similarly, you can think of me sending you a password over a text message, and then you have to type that password. And there we tested if I'll give you a word in your own language, like this. That will, how easy for you is that to type? Easy, right? How easy is it for you to type? Yeah, you will be hesitating much more. This is a word in Albanian. I think it was password. Was it correct? Yeah. I forgot. That's very funny. Yeah, so this is password in Albanian, and our two Albanian students will not have any problem typing that. Well, if I had to type it, it would be F-J-F-J-A-L-E-K. So I have to look at this word a number of times. There will be hesitations in this typing. So we detected that if we present people with words from their own language, they will be distinguishable from people who are typing in another language. Obviously, there are two students from Albania here. That doesn't help me distinguish between them, but we know that people generally have a different typing rhythm. So that's one thing also that we discovered. Language plays a role. Longer passwords give better performance. That's kind of obvious. The longer the password somebody has to type, the more features I can extract, the better I can distinguish between persons. Research that we'll do in the near future is actually related to this. Doesn't make sense a lot, but this is part of a keyboard where we can measure how far a key is pressed. So we can measure actually pressure or speed of pressing the key down, things like that, using this particular keyboard. I'll have a meeting tomorrow with the ones that are actually creating this keyboard. They're selling it, and so we'll see what how we can help each other with this. Yeah, so we'll do research on, okay, what if my keyboard doesn't only measure timing information, but also pressure information. They use it generally for gaming keyboards. Yeah, so anyway, keystroke dynamics can be very helpful in getting access or preventing access from imposers to a particular machine. So let's look at my laptop and see how we protect it. Well, if we want to see how it's protected, we'll have to see how we can get access to this machine. Well, one way of access to my machine is physically here and now. Yeah, and we use fingerprint or use password, so there is access control on this machine, so that's covered. Another way to get access to this machine is from a different location. Somebody could be sitting in America or in Asia or whatever and get access to my machine via that cable that is going in there. So via the network you can also get access. But for that we have virus scanners, we have intrusion detection system, firewalls, all of these things in place. Yeah, so we'll assume for now that is protected. This is an old picture, you know that, right? We don't use telephone lines anymore. But, so in principle, what we can say now is there are two ways of getting into this machine, via the network, I've covered that, and physical access, I've covered that. So we're safe. Only there is one small remaining problem. This is my computer. And so I get here to the office at 8 o'clock. I start working, reading documents, sending emails, typing PowerPoint presentations. And then at 10 o'clock, I get this feeling, this urge. Not sure if everybody has it, but I have it. Yeah, I need coffee. And luckily, not many of you have been to my office. My office and the kitchen area where there's a coffee machine, they're very close together, so that's great. So I'll get up, I'll go to the coffee machine. Ah, too bad, somebody is just cleaning it, and so I have to wait, and there are a few people in line before me who just came before me. And so I start talking to a colleague, and we're sitting there, and hikkelig, you know? Good Norwegian word. And so what's the problem then? Well, the problem is that this is my computer waiting in my office, and I'm in the kitchen area. And although very close, I can't see it. I don't have. So somebody could get in and have access to the machine. I already opened it for him. No, not for him. I opened it for me, but I left. And so it's standing there. I don't close it. I don't lock it because I was just getting a cup of coffee. Yeah, but now I'm 10 minutes in the kitchen area and somebody can get in there and can do anything that I can do. because my email is open, my documents are there, I can browse my hard disk. He can delete things. He can go to my email, send an email to the rector, call him all kinds of nasty stuff in my name. Yeah, the first thing I will notice that happened is the rector actually sending me an email that I can find a new job. Yeah, so somebody can actually hijack my PC physically because I did not lock it. And many people don't lock it. Who locks his computer every time that he leaves it? Okay. So we developed here a the thing is, I just logged onto my computer. I gave my username and password. And I'm going to start working with my computer. What I will be doing is using my keyboard and mouse all of the time. And I could follow how I typed my password. So why not follow how I type after I provided my password? And so we developed this concept of trust in the genuineness of a user, which means that this machine has some level of trust that I am the one typing on its keys and I'm the one using the mouse. And as long as it is me, that trust should be high. So here we have the trust will go up and down a bit. Yeah. So every time that we are at a particular trust level and I type one particular key, the system will check is, hey, was this key just typed as I expected, as I would normally do it? If the answer is yes, okay, then the trust can go a bit up. I trust the person a bit more. But if it is done differently, the trust will go down a bit. Yeah? And I'm not a robot. I don't type always exactly as in my profile. Yeah, there's small deviations. And so sometimes it will go up, but mostly it will stay high. But if somebody else is sitting behind my computer, you get a picture like this, because another person might have some overlaps with the typing rhythm that I have, because we're looking at so many keys. Yeah, but in many cases it will be different. So sometimes the trust will go up, but many times it will go down. And if it drops below some level, I say, no, now it's over, now I'll lock you out. But this is done in the experiment, so when the user got locked out, I had data from that user anyway, and I just said, okay, we pretend that you got locked in again, go ahead. And sometimes we see that they are detected very fast. Here there's some more time that they can spend before being detected. Yeah, but we can calculate some average there. How fast, how many keys can somebody type before they are kicked out? And so we did some measurements. We actually had an experiment, 53 users. For every user, we installed some software that measured everything they did. So we were very happy to get so many users. It's not a lot, but we were happy to get those because we monitor everything that they do. What keys are they typing? When are they pressing the key when releasing? How are they using the mouse from where to where? How are they clicking? Everything. For a period of 5 to 7 days, and over that period, each of them, on average, provided 42,000 actions. Let's talk about keystroke. That's the easiest. Forget about the mouse for the moment. Yeah, so on average they pressed 42,000 keys over that period, and which they provided to us. If I was checking my data against my own profile, against my own reference, I should say, then on average it took me 24,000 keystrokes to be locked out. Actually, it should never have happened. And for 50 people, it never happened. But 3 people were a bit more all over the place when typing, and so they got locked out sometimes, but only after 24,000 keystrokes. Well, if 42,000 keystrokes is 5 to 7 days, 24,000 keystrokes is more than a day. And in that period, I will lock my computer anyway. And once I lock on again, I just provided my password, I show that I am me, and the trust level is anyway 100 again. The imposter didn't do that well. 1 in 1,000 was not detected. That's something that we need to improve. But that's a small amount. But on average, an imposter could do 252 keystrokes before the system said, hey, this doesn't match. and they locked them out. Just to give you an idea of how much 252 keystrokes is. You have any idea how many keystrokes on this slide? If I'll add this sentence, I counted, it's 415. So this slide is 450 keystrokes. Anything included, shift key included, tab, whatever. Enter, all of those count, because it's a key and I press it. So this is over 400, so 252 is a small amount of information. So if you're sitting behind my computer sending this email to the director, hopefully you're not using too many, well, hopefully you're using a lot of bad words, because then you're just spending all those 252 actions and then it will lock. And you don't have time to send it. We did similar research with a mobile phone, because if you look at a mobile phone, you have a keyboard and a mouse too. Yeah, except... if I'm typing something, that's similar to a keyboard. If I'm swiping, that's similar to using a mouse. So those kind of analyses are very similar. We had two databases, one with 71 users, where they only had vertical and horizontal swipes. Genuine users never had a problem. Imposter users were locked out after 5 swipes on average. So if you get a hold of my phone and you're looking at my pictures, after 5 pictures, it will lock. Another database, there was slightly less users, but they did also tapping, so typing, and then we locked them out on average after 11 actions. So I would say quite good. So this was research what we did on so-called continuous authentication. Let me see where we are. Yeah, then about research that we are going to do in the near future. Who of you, by hands, who prefers kittens over puppies? Oh, that's shamingly few. Me too, by the way. Okay. Who prefers a holiday in the snow over a holiday in the sun? Someone. How about reading a book versus reading seeing a movie? I can ask who saw Game of Thrones and who read Game of Thrones. There's a difference there. And I could do this. I could also do that with astrology and astronomy. So, but the point is, people are different. People have different preferences. Yeah, we talked about soft biometrics. If I say if I divide this group in snow lovers and sun lovers, yeah, let's say it's a 50-50 split, but people belong to one of the two groups. But if I combine that with books and movies, all of a sudden I have 4 groups, and all of the groups becoming smaller and smaller, and so I'm zooming in. I'm extracting some information from people. Similarly, if I look at behavioral things like writing, and speaking, walking, and typing on the keyboard. I can actually, from the way that you speak, I can extract some information about you. From the way that you speak, I can make a good guess if you're a man or a woman. I can make a good guess if you are a child or an adult. If you're speaking English, I can probably make a good guess if you are natural as a mother tongue or if you learn it as a second language. And based on that, I might be even able to say that, okay, you're from Germany, you're from Albania, you're from the Netherlands, you're from wherever, from Norway. We know that when we look at a keyboard, when somebody types a password, we can determine if with high accuracy, so not perfectly, but with high accuracy, what is the gender of this person? What age group does he belong to? Is he left or right-handed? Is he typing with one or two hands? All of that just by typing a password. Who knows this girl? I think you should all know her. Who knows this girl? This is the same girl now. This is from a YouTube video, so she put on there. Who else? This is Amanda Todd. She's a Canadian teenager. She was 14 or 15 years old. She was 15 when she posted the video. She was in a chat room where she met a person, a Turkish person who was living in the Netherlands. Foolishly, she gave him a nude picture, or a nearly nude picture, I don't know. And the guy used that to press her to sending more and more, going worse every time. And at some point, she felt that she was in a place where she didn't want to be, and she actually committed suicide. This is, again, a Dutch person, Danny. Danny D, no last name. It's not just Dutch people doing this, by the way, but I read the Dutch news more than other. This guy was convicted because he actually met with a 13-year-old girl that he met in a chat room. And in court, he said in Dutch, sorry, but I will translate. He admitted that going too far, that's obvious. He said in that chat room, if I would have told them that I'm 41, nobody would have talked to me. He told the girls, he told the people in the chat room that he was 14. If you look at that picture, you know that he's not 14, right? Yeah, if I told you that I was 41, nobody wanted to chat with me, that might be obvious. Look at this. Who is the man over 50 years old here? Top row, right? That's logical. Who is the girl under 12? Yeah, green shirt. That's obvious, isn't it? You look at these, and it's obvious. Let's have another one. Who is the boy in this conversation? That's more difficult. I wouldn't know, actually. Let's try this one. Is this written by somebody under or over 40 years old? I would say under. That's relatively easy. I'm not sure if you can translate that. It took me a while. The project that we are starting up right now is called Chatroom Security. In a chat room, suppose that we have a chat room which is meant just for children. Yeah, and the Turkish guy from the Netherlands who was chatting with Amanda Todd or the Danny D guy, they should not be in there. But as they say, on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog. I can go into a chat room being 12-year-old Tina. Nobody would know, right? Nobody sees me. Nobody sees if it's a boy or a girl. Nobody sees if he's 12 years old or 40 plus, 50. Yeah? But we know that based on the use of language, we can distinguish between male and female. We can distinguish between age groups. Based on keystroke dynamics, we can find such information. So research was starting now, and I will be a PhD student starting hopefully in the next month, is collecting information from people in a chat room, collecting keystroke dynamics information, collecting linguistic information, and then determining, based on that, if, okay, here is a person who is saying his 12-year-old Katie, 12-year-old girl, is that correct? And if that system then says, no, this is probably a male, or this is probably somebody who is over 40, well, then obviously that person should be kicked out of the chat room, just to protect these children. And that we can do with biometrics. So then we don't get into situations like this anymore. So that was all I wanted to say about keystroke dynamics, some of the research we have done, some of the exciting research that we will do. Are there any questions? Question or not? Yeah, just shout.
For example, they will start with the index finger typing, Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Probably the ones in a chat room is a mixture. Probably if you just got to your first computer and you're typing with one finger and looking for all the keys, I'm not sure if you're in a chat room already. But are you typing like that or not? No, you're using all 10 fingers, right? So actually, the fact that somebody is typing so slowly is already one of the indications that, hey, this might not be an adult, this might be a child. Or I should say the other way around. The fact that somebody is typing fluently should be an indication that this is not a child. But on the other hand, my kids are spending more time behind their computer than probably I do behind mine. Although some of them are wearing out the ASDW keys. But they get fluent in typing rather fast. But I don't know what things to look at yet, but yeah, we can look at a number of things. That's part of the research. What kind of features do we have to look at to distinguish between male and female?
But not in context of the chat feeds, but in general, if you're using that as when you build authentication, for example, in addition to your password, the way you're typing the password,
yeah. No. The in principle, this is adding soft biometrics, right? Because I'm not identifying you. I just identify that you're a male, right? I'm not a female. So we have done research on typing a password and looked at soft biometrics information, and then we could determine with very good accuracy this is the gender and the age group and the left or right handedness, etc., etc. And then we use that information in addition to the normal. That we were using a distance metric, so a dissimilarity score, and on top of that we're using this soft information, and that improved the performance of the system. So it will not decrease the performance of the system. Yeah. Okay, good. I'm spending a lot of time here. Shall we quickly go over to Jürgen? So if you take the technology track, then biometrics is one of the courses that you have to take. And in that course, there is a number of projects defined, and you have to take one of those projects. And Jürgen did a project on what happens if I swap keyboard. Yeah, so I enroll with using one keyboard, the laptop keyboard, but then I do the authentication with another keyboard. Desktop keyboard, for example. So how will that? How will the system then react?
Okay, last question. You were talking about authentication, right? Last question. It's down there.
Was there a question?
Yeah, your last question about, you asked Patrick, right? You were talking about authentication. There are methods to update the template after a while. I think Patrick misunderstood your question. But there are research on updating templates as you go along, as you learn to type, as you change your dynamics. Okay, I'll present some of my preliminary research from the biometrics course last semester. The research were on the performance of keyboard dynamics between different hardware. So you use one keyboard for enrollment and another keyboard to then log in later. This could be used for remote access, or if you come to your office and you plug your computer into a docking station and use an external keyboard. My research were primarily as a second factor authentication. So you type a password, we can look at the typing rhythm at the same time. So when you type your password several times every day, like you're unlocking your computer, you do that maybe 50 times a day, you have a very distinct rhythm when you're typing. You probably noticed when you type wrong sometimes, you know it the second you type wrong, that you did something wrong. You don't have to wait for the computer to tell you that password was wrong. You feel it at the in the same moment. So ideally, I wanted participants to use their own password because they have the muscle memory already. But to test the biometric system, if I were using my password, I would have to give you or the other participants my password so they can use the same password to see if they can get access. And my participants didn't want to give away their password, of course. So alternatively, we could generate a random password and have everyone train with that password, learn that password. But it would be time consuming, and all participants would develop some sort of speed and accuracy on the same password. So while still having different rhythms, they would all be having some sort of rhythm. So I decided to use names. My theory is that all the participants have written their own name enough times to develop a distinct typing rhythm. And by using first and last names, capitalizing the first letter, there's some sort of complexity in a name as a password. Almost no warm-up required, and the participants' actual passwords are not disclosed. So I had 15 participants, two different keyboard, and everyone sat down for one session. Each participant would get 50 tasks on each keyboard. They wrote their own name 20 times, and then each of the other participants' names 2 times. And then I had a long text task so that I could test for continuous authentication, where Patrick talked about the trust level. But I didn't have time to do that research, so those texts were unused. So this is what I did. I made a simple web application. I programmed in all the tasks that each participant was supposed to do. So when the participants were chosen, you get assignment or task 1 out of 100. In the blue box is what you're supposed to write. In the gray box comes as you're typing. When you press enter, the information is sent to an endpoint to be recorded. If the text is correct with capitalizations, spaces, everything, it jumps to the next task. If it's wrong, it just clears the screen and you have to try again. On the right hand, you can see the two different keyboards. Was this laptop and the same keyboard that's used in most other keyboard dynamic testing. This might be hard to see, but this is from the database. For each task, I created an entry that looked like this. Oh, this. You had the user ID, the word that they tried to type, the browser it was typed in, and what keyboard it would type with. For each of those entries, I recorded all the events. So if you can see here, ID 1698, that's from here on down, or here on down. So you see the first key with 1968 is here. That's the shift pressed down, and then the J is pressed, the J is released, and the shift is released. So it's a capital J. This was me writing my name. And then all the other letters. 1 is key down, 0 is key up. Down here you can see that both G and E are keyed down before G is released. That's pretty common when you type a lot on the keyboard. You press 2 keys down before releasing the first key. So I tried different combinations. I tried 5 samples for the template. And for each keyboard, they write their name 20 times. So you would get 15 same keyboard genuine comparisons. And when I talk about genuine comparisons, that's me trying to get into my system, and imposters, that's me trying to get into someone else's system. I tried with both, or 5 samples, 10 samples, and 15 samples. No matter how many samples I used for templates, there was also 20 different keyboard genuine comparisons. So me writing my own name with another keyboard, 28 same keyboard imposter comparisons, so other people trying to write my name on the same keyboard, and the same with a different keyboard. I tried with using Manhattan distance. I tried using scaled Manhattan distance. I tried with 5, 10, and 15 samples, with and without outlier removal. And outlier removal is you take, if you have some data that's way outside the normal. So here I think I used outside 3 standard deviations. I removed it. And I tried with durations, with latencies, and with both durations and latencies. And as Patrick's talked about, duration is the time you use to press the key, the time the key is down, and latency is the time between 2 keys. So here's a big table of my results. So in the method column, you have MD for Manhattan distance and SMD for scaled Manhattan distance. D for duration, L for latency, and DL for both, and then outlier removal if that was used. Here's the verification keyboard. Enrollments done with 5, 10, and 15 samples. And the enrollment phase is done with the same or the different keyboard as what's displayed here. So I used bold fonts on the best results. And 2 things stick out here. The first one is that 15 samples in most cases outperforms using fewer samples for the template, so the template gets better. Also, all the best results are using the same keyboard. Now, that might not be surprising, but some of the research I read actually concluded that using different keyboards actually outperform using the same keyboard. So I was not sure what to expect. This is a plot of the scaled Manhattan distance with 10 samples for enrollment on a laptop keyboard. The threshold here is measured in distance, so the distance between the template and the probe. So a smaller number is a closer relation to the template. And here you can see that the equal error rates are where the lines are crossing. And you see that the blue line are the laptop keyboard and the green line are the laptop keyboard. So you have a crossing here and a crossing here. So when you use an authentication system, you set a threshold. If you set a low threshold in this distance system, you see that everyone gets, or every genuine logging attempt gets a false non-match. So if I have a threshold here, I won't get into my own system. Neither will anybody else, but I won't get in, so it doesn't help. The further I move here, the higher chances for me to get into my system, but also the chances of an imposter getting in is increasing. On the far other side here, everyone's let in. I'm let in every time, but so is every imposter as well. So my conclusions was using the same keyboard for enrollment and verification outperforms using different keyboards. And it's still possible to recognize individuals with different keyboards, but the false non-match rate would be higher for any given threshold. Okay. Any questions? Okay, good.
So I'm going to talk about some fingerprinting today and the different types of methods that are used to detect fingerprints and different types of shapes. I don't know if Patrick already covered this somewhat in class. Some? Okay. Yeah. So what we speak about when we talk about fingerprinting is usually dactyloscopy, which means the different shapes that are on your hand or in your finger, and the golden details which make these shapes. We'll get back to that, but before we have some history lesson. And what you might not know about fingerprinting is that it has a very, very long history. Actually, all the way back to, I think it's 4000 BC, where they used pottery to take a fingerprint. And also the first, first deal that is made on a fingerprint goes all the way back to 750 AD, which is a loan for money, 10% interest. But anyway, dactyloscopy goes back to the 1686, where Marcello Malpighi found that he had several types of patterns and formations, but he couldn't really see anything extraordinary about that. He just found that there were some different types of patterns. But then some other old guys found that during a study on fingerprints, they found that their fingerprints were actually unique. So he had he knew that fingerprinting were unique, and Purkinje made a categorization for the nine shapes that we have today on our finger or hand. Later, we have the first actual use of fingerprinting that's recorded. That's from William J. Herschel, who tried to pay soldiers their money, but was having problem with people pretending that they were someone else. So he actually is the first one to implement palm and fingerprint to see if the person that is trying to get the fund is actually the person. And he, during a study on his own hand, found out that his fingerprints were persistent. He studied his own fingerprint for about 20 years. So the point is that fingerprinting is not a new technique. It's very, very old. And it's one of the most researched types of authentication that we have. So then we come to the actual classifications that is made on fingerprinting. Galton, he used fingerprinting for crime scene investigations. I think it's 1823 or something. And he found the different types of details that's on your finger, which makes up for the shapes. And that's what we look for when we use fingerprinting on our phones, the minutia points. They are created by Galton Regis. Henry made he improved the classification. So we know now how nine different types of patterns that we can distinguish on our thumb. We will come back to those. And this is what we have today in our we use those patterns today, so it's quite old. Just some statistics on why is that coming now. Anyway, here you can see the different types that they found. There are arches, loops, and whorls, and the FBI later use those, but have some different types of subcategories. We'll get into them. So I'll come back to those. To understand what we are looking for, is a core is a point where the ridge of your fingerprint goes like this, and the core is on top in the ridge. This is used to find different types of shapes. And also, delta is a point that's easily found if it exists. It's a point where three endings meet, so they make a river kind of. I'll get back to it. So then we move on to what actually the basic patterns are. Right loop this one is better. There you can see what forms the right loop, and you can see the clearer the loop is here, and it has, as you can see, a core which is on top of the curve, and then you see the river that I was talking about, where two different points go through. So, to identify loops, you have to have at least one core and one delta, and then you have exactly the same thing, but for the left side. And you see the delta has moved to the left side, but the core is still in the same of the shape. Then you have a whorl, and it's very, very easy to distinguish because it goes like this. And you can see that in the next picture. It's like a whirlwind, just becoming smaller and smaller and smaller. And there you see that the core is on top of the curve, and that the deltas are on two different sides of the point. So they move upwards, and the same for the other point. And then they have another characteristic, which is an arch, and that goes just basic arches. You can see it's more better shown here, and it just moves up and has no particular type of curving or where you can find cores or deltas. And here they are in different types of in examples. We will have some handouts for you, so you can try to apply this for yourself. And we also have we are also going to look at some of the golden details before you get these, so you can try to identify them for yourself. I will also give this PowerPoint out, so you can try to distinguish and look at them. This is basically what I said earlier. So the arch goes like this, and you have a point where it has no significant delta or a core, and then there's a tented arch which has three different characteristics of what a arch is. Here we are. These are the golden details, and this might be possible to see on your finger if you look very, very closely. These are the lines in your finger that, for example, the ridge ending, it ends abruptly within your finger. And then there's the bifurcation where two lines meet, and then they cross, they diverge. And there's also trifurcation where three lines meet, and they do the same. You can you can also have lakes, which are where lines diverge and get back together and forms a type of column or something where there is no space. And then there are line crossings, which are fairly obvious, that are just lines crossing. And then there are line breaks, which are just abrupt endings and startings of new lines. And then there are short lines, which are just short lines. And then there are crossovers, which are lines diverging. They're not leading anywhere, they're just crossing. You can easily see them, for example, in this example. I don't know if it's visible to you, but we can, for example, look at this point, where you can see that there's a line break. There's nothing continuing going on here. And there's a short line, maybe not that easy to see. And here, this is probably the best one. You can see that there's an island.
Just opposite to the left of the island, there seem to be line breaks,
yeah.
But those are not line breaks, real line breaks. That's just the sensor not capturing everything. And while the line break that is selected, really the other two ridges, they are coming close and then diverging again. So then that particular ridge that has a line break is called that.
Can you not apply some filters on this image in order to see it better?
Do you know, Gujang, if this is applied?
This is the raw image.
Yeah.
There's no binarization or anything applied to that, but generally speaking, in fingerprint recognition, we don't work with this image. We are trying to determine, this seemingly line break that I just mentioned, is that a real line break, or is that because of the quality of the sensor or the biometric sample captured, etc., etc. So there is a lot of image processing before we go and determine, this is a rich ending, this is a rich bifurcation, etc., etc.
Yeah, so we have a fingerprinting station there. So if you want, you can come up and get your fingerprint examined. And that will extract the different details I was talking about and make a signature of that. We also have some...
We have a number of fingerprints that we will hand out, but we would like to have back. So just I will hand out these to everybody. I will give three different fingerprints to a small group of people. So just have a look at it. Look at the different qualities. Look at the if you can identify a number of rich endings and rich bifurcations. Those are the ones that are mostly used. See if you can determine the global pattern that was talked about. So is there a loop? Can you see a loop? Can you see a delta? Can you see an arch? Can you see...
That's mine.
Yeah, that's yours. That's a special one. So play a bit with it based on the presentation from Emil. Yeah? Maybe sometimes three people have to sit together so everybody can work on three sets. Yeah?
Three.